Hello, everyone. I'm Drew.
I'm Bailey.
I'm Lacey.
And we're sarcastic, so let's get sinister. Hi, friends.
Hey.
Before we start recording, I just want to make a quick disclaimer. I've had a cough for a couple days. And I think that it's made my voice a little raspy, and I also have to cough every now and then. So just to disclaim.
Maybe you'll sound better with the raspiness.
Maybe it's like Phoebe from Friends.
A real smelly cat situation. Sing for us.
What was that?
It's a notification on my phone.
Well, phone coming. Just...
Bailey's more popular than we are.
No, it's my work chat. It's coming through on my laptop because it's connected. Yeah, sing Smelly Cat. Let's get a nice rendition.
Oh, Smelly Cat. Smell. I tried to do raspy. Tried to lean into the raspy. Smelly Cat. Smelly Cat.
Don't quit your day job.
I wasn't planning on it, if I'm being honest. Alrighty.
What are we hearing about today?
Well, do you remember, did the screen just get smaller?
No.
Okay. Lacey, what did we talk about last week?
Last week we talked about the Hall Mills murder in New Brunswick, New Jersey, which captured America's attention in the media for about 10 years until another tragedy struck that distracted everybody.
What tragedy?
The Lindbergh kidnapping.
That's what we're talking about today.
Oh my God, you guys.
So well
executed. Really good work.
Thank you.
I'm sure everyone's going to buy that was authentic.
Well, the first recording was really rough, but I think we got it.
Yeah. There was a lot. Anyway. All right. So Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. was born June 22nd, 1930 to Charles and Anne Morrow Lindbergh. So Anne Spencer Morrow Lindbergh was born June 22nd, 1906 in Englewood, New Jersey. Her parents were extremely successful college sweethearts. Dwight Morrow, Anne's father, was a partner at J.P. Morgan before becoming the U.S. ambassador to Mexico.
Oh.
He was awarded the Distinguished Service Medal for his contributions during World War I. And in 1930, he was elected to the U.S. Senate representing New Jersey. He held that position until his death in October 1931. He was a renowned diplomat and lawyer, and in his honor, a public school in Englewood was named Dwight Morrow High School, and a World War II cargo ship was named the SS Dwight W. Morrow. Before all of that, in 1903, he married Elizabeth Cutter. He and Elizabeth had four children, Dwight Jr., Constance, Anne, and Elizabeth. Elizabeth Cutter, nicknamed Betty, was born to Charles and Annie. And I didn't want to go too deep into the family tree, but I did think it was funny that Elizabeth, her parents were named Charles and Annie, and then she had a daughter named Anne who married a guy named Charles.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Those are very common names.
Yeah, and I'm sure she named her daughter Anne after her mom. So it was pretty, but it's just fun because if you look at the family tree, it's like
a lot of repetition.
Anne, Charles, Elizabeth, Anne, Charles. Betty shared her parents with a twin sister as well as three younger sisters. Both Betty and her twin, Mary, were sickly children, and after falling ill in 1879, the family moved to New Orleans so the warm weather would cure the girls. As it did. In November 1882, Betty's sister died of tuberculosis. As a result, her parents sent Betty to live with her uncle, Dr. John Spencer, in Ohio. Betty recovered.
So it just feels like a weird chain of events. I think Bailey and I had the same thought at the same time.
Okay. So the logic was the kids were sick, were leaving Jersey for New Orleans.
Yeah, because of the warm weather.
Right. Oh, God. Tuberculosis happened.
Ohio. Mary died. Yeah. Well, so I think they were like, the girls are sick. We need to get them into the warm weather because I don't know if you're aware, but at the time, everybody thought tuberculosis could be cured by the sun. Mm-hmm.
There were like camps and stuff out west they would send people to.
Yeah. So they took the girls to New Orleans for the warm weather and then Mary died. So they must have been like, well, it's not working. Why don't we send Elizabeth to, or Betty, to live with her uncle who happens to be a doctor in Ohio?
Oh, you're thinking because he was a doctor, they were like, maybe if she's with him, he could do better.
Okay, I'm not thinking that. That's what they thought. They were like, better send her to live with the doctor in Ohio. It wasn't because they were like, the warm weather's not working, let's move back to the cold. Yeah. It's because, let's put her with a doctor.
Yeah, it felt like they were saying, well, one daughter died, let's get rid of this other one. I didn't catch that. The uncle was a doctor.
The son is better like, why in Ohio.
Yeah.
My thought was, they thought the son would be better at treating their sickly children than the doctor.
Yeah, in fact, they started with a cross-country move instead of
the 1880s, to be specific. Yeah. So Betty recovered from her illness, but through this whole time, she gained a love of books, reading, and writing. Mm. In 1893, while Betty was a sophomore at Smith College, she met Dwight. After a few years of courting, the two married and settled in Englewood. Yes, because back then it was courting. Eventually, they moved into a home which they named Next Day Hill Estate.
Okay. Side note. When I have my home, I'm naming it.
Okay.
I'm going to do that.
That's fine. I think that's fun. Lacey looks confused as to why they called it the Next Day Hill Estate. It's a play on their last name, which is Morrow.
Morrow. Okay.
Good Morrow.
Like tomorrow.
Okay. It's cute. Well, I'll take it.
Yeah. After Dwight was appointed the ambassador to Mexico, the family had to get a second home in Mexico. They named that home Casa Mañana.
Ha.
I like these people.
Like translates to tomorrow home. After Dwight's death, Betty became the first female president of Smith College. In 1954, Betty suffered a stroke and became comatose, dying 2 months later. During her life, Betty was a philanthropist and advocate for women's education. She wrote poetry and children's books and loved collecting Mexican artwork.
Go Betty.
Anne was the couple's, huh?
I said, go Betty.
Mm-hmm. Anne was the couple's second child. She learned to read and write at an early age due to her mother's routine of reading to the children for an hour every night. Anne was the president of her student body at the Chapin School in New York City until she graduated in 1924. Like her mother, she attended and graduated from Smith College. She earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in 1928. And in 1930, Anne became the first American woman to earn a glider pilot's license. She served as co-pilot, navigator, and radio operator on numerous flights, logging over 40,000 miles across 5 continents. She won several awards in aviation and became an acclaimed author, writing poetry, novels, and nonfiction. She also published several volumes of her diaries and letters. She and Charles Lindbergh met in December 1927 in Mexico City. Charles Augustus Lindbergh was born February 4th, 1902 in Detroit, although he spent most of his childhood in Minnesota and D.C. His father, Carl Manson, was born in Stockholm, Sweden. He was the son... Real quick, I put a lot of effort into this slide, so I want you to pay attention to it, okay?
All right.
His father, Carl Manson, was born in Stockholm, Sweden. He was the son of Ola Manson and his mistress, Lovisa Carlin.
Ola.
Olin worked as a bank manager, but after being accused of bribery and embezzlement, Ola changed his name to August Lindbergh, then fled to the United States in 1859 with Lovisa and Carl, leaving behind his wife and seven children.
Ha! Huh. Oh. I like the way your slide did that. I like that. You had that stuff hidden behind his picture. He's sneaky.
Upon immigrating, did you notice that I changed his name too when he did?
Yes, yeah. I'm very good. Impressed.
Upon immigrating, Lovisa changed her name to Louisa, and Carl became Charles August Lindbergh.
Okay.
Wow. August and Louisa had six more children together before they married in 1885. They had to wait for August's actual wife to die, which she did in Sweden in 1864. Then they waited like 20 more years before they got married. I don't really know why, but maybe it took a while for him to find out.
They had to be sure
that she really was truly dead.
Well, and that they wanted to be together. Like,
that's fair. They only had seven children together, so
he also had 14 kids.
That sure man did. Fertile.
Yes. So this is baby Charles, the Lindbergh baby, the one that we're talking about. His grandfather, Charles, came to the U.S. as an infant. He grew up to become a lawyer and was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1906. In 1887, Charles married Mary LaFond, and together they had three daughters, Edith, Lillian, and Eva, although Edith died as an infant. In 1898, Mary died after abdominal surgery, and in 1901, Charles married Evangeline Lodge Land. They had their son in 1902, and that's kind of when the trouble started. Evangeline found it difficult raising her stepdaughters and often threatened her husband with divorce. By 1909, the two were living in separate residences and were officially separated in 1918. Evangeline Lodge Land was born and raised in Detroit. She was a high school chemistry teacher. Her father was a dentist who pioneered porcelain and gold tooth crowns, and her uncle was a repeat mayor of Detroit. Following their separation in 1920, Evangeline and her son rented rooms at a boarding house in Madison while Charles attended college. In 1925, Evangeline graduated with a master's degree in education and worked as a chemistry teacher until she retired in 1942. Okay, now that we got the backstory, let's focus in on Charles.
All right. I have a question.
Which Charles?
First of all, going forward, I'm going to be referring to the Lindbergh baby as Charlie.
Okay.
Okay.
And then I'm not really going to be talking about their family anymore. So when I say Charles, I'm talking about Charlie's dad.
Okay.
Got it.
Okay. What's your question?
Which of us?
Lacey.
Okay.
I have a question.
Oh, I thought we said at the same time we had a question. First, an observation I thought was funny was that when you had the first slide up of the family tree, we were like, oh, cute, Annie, Anne, Charles. Mm-hmm. Now it's like Charles, August, Augustus.
Yeah.
My question is, so August's son was Charles Augustus Lindbergh.
Yes.
His son was Charles Augustus Lindbergh. So why wasn't that son a junior?
Oh, I'm sorry. So August Lindbergh,
mm-hmm.
previously known Ola,
yeah.
Changed his son's original name was Carl. He changed it to Charles August.
Okay.
Sorry. And so then his son was Augustus.
Yeah, so then it wasn't the same. Okay.
So Charlie is a junior. Mm-hmm. His dad is Charles Augustus. And then his dad is Charles August.
Okay.
And then his dad is just August.
Because that is such a huge change.
Yeah, I know. It just added like a little bit extra, but it the extra US on the end of the middle name prevented the JR.
I have an uncle who his son had his name but different middle names, although not like almost literally the same name. And then the son, my cousin, when he had his son, he made him a junior. So it was like the same situation, but their middle names were different than just August to Augustus.
So Charles Jr., sorry, not Charles Jr., Charles, as in dad. Charles enrolled in the College of Engineering at the University of Wisconsin. He dropped out in the middle of his sophomore year. He had chose to major in engineering because from an early age, he'd been fascinated by mechanics, focusing on motorized transportation. After leaving school in 1922, he enrolled at the Nebraska Aircraft Corporation's flying school in Lincoln. He unfortunately was not permitted to fly solo because he couldn't afford to pay the required damage bond, which is like insurance. So like if he crashed the plane, he would have to pay for it, but he couldn't afford to pay for it. So he wasn't allowed to fly. Understood?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the matter?
Well, if he crashes the plane, he has to pay for it. But like, what's the likelihood of his survival if he crashes the plane?
That's why they want it paid up front.
Oh.
He left that school after a few months and began barnstorming, wing walking, and parachuting.
Oh.
Barnstorming.
Barnstorming.
Oh, I'm so happy you asked. Barnstorming was a form of entertainment where stunt pilots performed tricks. That's just it. You know, when they're like flying upside down at like a circus or something.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then wing walking is self-explanatory.
While the plane
is flying, they walk along the wings.
Yeah.
So he just started doing like entertainment and performing and stuff like that.
When you said barnstorming, because we're in Lincoln, Nebraska, I was like, it sounds something like an Amish person would do.
Well, I think that it came from, I feel like I've seen people fly a plane through a barn as a trick.
What? Oh.
To me, barnstorming sounds like there's a party going on in a barn and a group of people are crashing the party. They're like storming the party. That's what barnstorming sounds
okay.
like. And that's what I'll think of it as after we're done with this case.
Okay. He also briefly worked as an airplane mechanic at an airport in Montana. With the onset of winter, Charles took a break from flying and from planes, but returned in May of 1923. He bought a World War I surplus Curtiss J-9-4 biplane for $500. These planes were often like nicknamed a Jenny because it's a J-9 or a JN. So it was called the Jenny. And he finally flew a plane solo for the first time. He flew 140 miles from Georgia to Alabama. He spent the remainder of his year barnstorming under the name Daredevil Lindbergh, flying his Jenny. But it seemed Charles would take any opportunity to fly. Twice, he flew a physician across the Wisconsin River to an emergency call. So he was being an emergency pilot. And once he flew his father, who at the time was running for Senate, even though he didn't get it, to a campaign spot in Minnesota. Following a few months of barnstorming through the South, Lindbergh reported to Brooks Field in Texas on March 19, 1924, to begin a year of military flight training with the U.S. Army Air Service. 8 days before graduating, Lindbergh had his most serious flying accident. He'd had accidents before, broken propellers, once he ran into a ditch, and one time he cracked up an aircraft after the engine failed. Each time he managed to repair the damage himself, but on March 5th, 1925, Charles had a mid-air collision with another Army aircraft during aerial combat maneuvers. He was forced to bail out. Little parachute.
Yeah. How do you, if you're flying, how does a ditch just pop out of nowhere?
I believe he was landing.
Oh. You Marta mentioned the dish, and I was like, I mean, it was it like a pothole or something? Like,
I believe he was landing, and I want to point out that I think that most of his flying experience was self-taught. Even though he did go to, like, the Wisconsin Flying School, he didn't fly the plane then. Like, he wasn't allowed to do solo flying. So, like, he kind of just did it himself. Anyway. That crash in the air did not impact his graduation. So, he graduated first of his class overall and earned his Army pilot's wings. And a commission as a second lieutenant in the Air Service Reserves. Because the Army didn't need any additional active duty pilots at the time, Charles returns to barnstorming and became a flight instructor. Since he was in the reserves, he had to do part-time military flying for the National Guard, and in December he was promoted to first lieutenant, and then 7 months later he was promoted to captain. In October 1925, Charles was hired as a chief pilot for the Contract Air Mail Route 2 in Missouri. In April, he took the U.S. Post Office Department's oath of mail messengers. Did you know that that was a thing?
Is that where they're like in sleet and snow?
No, I think that that's their. I think that's just their like motto. But like they have to take an oath.
What do you think?
I don't know.
I promise to lick every stamp and not open a letter that doesn't have my name on it.
I feel like the second part's probably close, but I think you're supposed to apply your own stamps, Bailey.
That's what else are they there for then?
Well, I'll tell you what he did. He flew 278 miles delivering mail.
Okay.
He provided service between St. Louis, Missouri. St. Louis. Whatever. Missouri. To Chicago. On two occasions, combinations of bad weather, equipment failure, and fuel exhaustion forced Lindbergh to bail out on night approach to Chicago. Both times he reached the ground without serious injury. Now, this is what Charles is most famous for. And why the Lindbergh baby kidnapping was so high profile to the point that it overshadowed Lacey, her story. In 1919, so we're backing up a little bit, two British aviators won a prize for the first nonstop transatlantic flight from Newfoundland to Ireland. At the same time, a French-born New York hotelier named Raymond Ortegue put up a $25,000 reward. That's about $450,000 today. For the first successful nonstop transatlantic flight from New York City to Paris.
It was just a random rich guy.
Yeah. Yeah. People like approached him from like plane industry and were like, hey, wouldn't this be cool? And he was like, he sure would.
The rich people always just been like, what should I do with my money?
Yeah.
Okay.
So he put like a 5-year disclaimer thing on it and nobody was interested at that point. So then after 5 years, he renewed the offer. This time it attracted many well-known, highly experienced and well-financed contenders. The first attempt was made in September 1926 by a World War I flying ace who crashed on takeoff, killing crew members. The following April, a second attempt was made by U.S. naval aviators who were killed while testing their airliner.
Jesus.
The following month, in May, French war heroes departed Paris but disappeared somewhere in the Atlantic after last being seen crossing the west coast of Ireland.
What's going on?
It was dangerous times back then. Charles was inspired by the first attempt that was made in September of 1926. He soon discussed this idea with a St. Louis, Missouri businessman and other supporters. In mid-February of 1927, Charles secured financial backing. He approached several aircraft manufacturers looking for a custom long-range plane. Ryan Airlines in San Diego agreed to build it. Charles took a train to San Diego to oversee the design and construction of the Spirit of St. Louis.
Hmm.
Or the Spirit of St. Louis.
Side note, I found the oath for the U.S. Postal Service.
Okay, is it long?
Yes.
Okay.
pretty much the gist is that they... it's a pledge taken by all Postal Service officers and employees. The oath is mandated by law, requires them to support and defend the U.S. Constitution, bear true faith and allegiance to it, and faithfully discharge the duties of their office.
Okay.
So
Google says... Google says that I'm supposed to say St. Louis. So okay. I think
that maybe you're thinking about Louisville.
Probably.
Yeah.
I'm all discombobulated. I'm not... My throat is all over the place.
It's a weird day.
She also kept up on Newfoundland.
I know. I said Newfoundland, and then I was like, nope, it's Newfoundland. The Spirit of St. Louis was a custom-built single-engine, single-seat, high-wing monoplane. The Ryan team built the Spirit of St. Louis in just 60 days, working to Lindbergh's specifications, including an extra fuel capacity of 450 gallons and a design that prioritized range over visibility. So instead of like a window, he had a periscope.
No thanks.
There, also, he's right behind the fuel tank.
Yeah. Where do you want to sit?
You know, I want to sit right on top of it.
Yeah, it's nice and warm.
Yeah.
The night before his flight, Charles was unable to sleep. On May 20th, 1927, at 7:52 a.m., Charles Lindbergh took off from Roosevelt Field on Long Island, New York. 3 hours later, he started to feel tired. To keep his mind clear, he descended and flew only 10 feet above the water surface. Feels dangerous if you're tired.
Yeah.
Around 21 hours into the flight, Charles began to hallucinate, continually falling asleep and then awakening and then falling back asleep. Still feels very dangerous.
Yeah.
At 10:22 p.m. Paris time, on May 21st, 1927.
Your birthday.
Yeah. Charles Lindbergh landed in Paris 33 and a half hours after takeoff. He had flown 3,610 miles on the first solo, nonstop transatlantic flight. For this, he won the $25,000.
Feels like he should have gotten more.
It was $450,000.
Yeah.
At the time.
I feel like he should have gotten more.
Okay. Well, he got a lot. Can I tell you what he got?
What did he get?
He received unprecedented acclaim after this historic flight. Lindbergh became an international celebrity with invitations pouring in for him to visit European countries. He received marriage proposals, invitations to visit cities across the U.S., and thousands of gifts, letters, and endorsement requests. After landing in Paris, the Spirit of St. Louis was housed at the U.S. Embassy for safekeeping, while Charles spent weeks touring European cities, all which welcomed him with banquets and parades.
Pilots were big deals.
Well, what he did was a big deal. Upon his return to the U.S., President Calvin Coolidge presented him with the Distinguished Flying Cross and later the Medal of Honor. He began a three-month tour of the U.S., flying to all 48 continental states in the Spirit of St. Louis, giving speeches and promoting aviation safety. This caused a Lindbergh boom, which is a surge of pilot training, licensed aircrafts, and new airports across the country.
I thought it was going to be like a baby boom, where people were like so excited about advancements in flying that there was a big boom in babies after Lindbergh did his flight.
He preached and talked about aviation safety?
Yes. Wear your seatbelts and stuff.
While he was hallucinating while flying?
He got there.
Okay. You're right. That makes, yeah.
In, okay, so he's touring everywhere. In December 1927, Charles was invited to fly the Spirit of St. Louis on a goodwill tour of Latin America and the Caribbean by the U.S. Ambassador Dwight Morrow.
Ooh.
This is when Charles Lindbergh met Anne Morrow.
Oh.
Yeah. He returned to Mexico several times to visit her, and he invited her to fly with him. He taught her navigation and basic piloting skills. So all that flying co-piloting thing was with her hubby. Kind of nice.
Is he... Does he look like Slender Man to anyone else in that second photo?
Either he's real tall, or she's little.
Or
I feel like it's probably a combination of both.
What was the character's name in The Conjuring 2? The really tall guy, lanky guy with the weird hat.
No idea.
I don't know if it had a name. It wasn't like okay. like the dog turned into it or something, and then it
did it.
Oh no. There was a name.
Anyway.
Okay, well, Charles was 6'3".
It's giving that.
Charles was 6'3", so I'm going to say Anne was probably around 5'6 or 5'5".
You think she was that short?
5'7"?
I think she's like 5'9".
Okay, can we move on?
No, Google it. I want to know.
Crooked Man.
It doesn't have it. She wasn't famous enough.
Oh, you're Aww. Telling me no one measured her in her years?
They fell in love in the sky.
Aww.
On May 27th, which is our parents' anniversary, 1929, the two married in a small secret ceremony in Englewood. They honeymooned on a cross-country flight.
That was on their flight.
Yep. On June 22nd, 1930, Charles and Anne welcomed their first baby, Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. I don't know if you guys caught it, but Anne gave birth to Charlie on her 24th birthday.
Aw.
Like me. Charles had a typical life for a baby of a wealthy, prominent family. He was often cared for by nannies and other household staff. Though Anne and Charles were very involved parents. Even as an infant, he attracted tons of media attention. His parents were careful and diligent in shielding him from the publicity. By all accounts, Charles was a typical normal baby. He hit all normal milestones and was healthy. When he turned about a year old, he started traveling with his parents more, although Anne and Charles remained cautious of the press. In early 1932, the Lindberghs moved from their home in Englewood to a more secluded home, sometimes called the Little House, on a large estate measuring... So I don't know how big it was. I saw something from like 110 acres to 340 acres. It was a big, big estate.
On how the big rural... an acre?
Huh?
How big's an acre?
Big.
Okay.
I don't know. Google it. The house was located on the rural outskirts of Hopewell, New Jersey. During the last weekend in February 1932, baby Charlie was suffering from a cold. On Tuesday, March 1st, Charles and Anne were spending a quiet evening at home. Charlie's nurse, Betty Gow, rubbed medication on his chest to relieve congestion. Then at 7:30 p.m., Anne and Betty put 20-month-old Charlie to bed in his nursery. He was wearing what was described as a one-piece coverall night suit. Afterwards, Betty and the Lindberghs spent the next 1 to 2 hours doing their separate evening chores and activities. When Betty finished, she headed to bed herself, but checked on Charlie beforehand, as she did every night. At 10 p.m., she made a terrible discovery. I feel like you know what it is based on the title, but...
No, what is it?
Charlie's nursery was located on the corner of the second floor of the house, near the master bedroom where his parents slept. His crib was located against a wall, but close to a window that overlooked the property, away from direct drafts, but close to natural light and ventilation. The room had typical nursery furnishings, a crib, changing table, rocking chair. The decor was simple, comfortable, and functional. Betty alerted the Lindberghs of what she had found. Charles rushed to the nursery and confirmed the crib was empty.
Oh.
Baby Charlie was gone.
Maybe Charlie got up out of his crib.
He was 20 months old, so it is possible.
I was just going to ask how old he is because I kind of lost track. Okay.
20 months. Charles immediately noticed the open window and found a strange-looking envelope sitting on the sill.
That's
Charles.
I said that's risky, leaving an envelope on a windowsill with the window open.
Window? Mm-hmm. Fair. Charles went downstairs, grabbed his rifle. Then he and the family butler, Ollie Whateley, ran outside. Under the window of the nursery, the pair found impressions on the ground, pieces of a wooden ladder, and a baby blanket.
Oh.
Ollie notified local authorities while Charles called his lawyer and friend, Henry Breckenridge. The Hopewell police called the New Jersey State Police and turned the investigation over to them. Officers searched the home and surrounding area. A ladder was discovered some distance from the Lindberghs home, broken at a point where two sections were joined, and footprints were found leading into the woods at the edge of the property. By 10:30 p.m., radio news bulletins were announcing the story nationally. Nearly every newspaper in the country gave the story prominent placement in their March 2nd editions. Soon, sightings of the baby were coming from all over, California, Michigan, Mexico, but none turned out to be genuine. The strange-looking envelope on the windowsill contained a poorly written ransom note. And by poorly written, I mean the handwriting sucked and the grammar was poor. Charles insisted that nobody touch the envelope until it was dusted for fingerprints. 2 hours later, after midnight, the envelope was finally analyzed, then opened. The note inside read, quote, "Dear sir, have $50,000 ready," spelled R-E-D-Y, $2,500 in $20 bills, $15,000 in $10 bills, and $10,000 in $5 bills. After 2 to 4 days, we will inform you were to deliver the money. We warn you for making any ding public or for the police, spelled with an S instead of a C. The child is in gut care. Indication for all letters are signature and three holes. So the person who wrote this letter said that basically to ensure the validity of all the letters that we send you, pay attention to the signature and three holes. What's he referring to is at the bottom of that note, there were two interconnected blue circles surrounding a red circle and a hole punched through the red circle and two more holes to the left and the right. That's a recreation that I'm showing you there.
It looks like a Venn diagram.
Yes. Despite it being preserved, no usable fingerprints were found on the envelope or note. Professionals concluded that the writer was likely one person and they were likely foreign, but had spent some time in the U.S. The latter was analyzed. No usable fingerprints or footprints were found. Police realized that the ladder was built incorrectly, although it was likely built by someone who knew how to work with wood and had construction experience. Police had a professional see how many different types of wood were used and what pattern was made by the nail holes and if it had been made indoors or outdoors. They like analyzed the crap out of this ladder. They found that it was homemade.
What year was
investigators this? Pardon?
What year was this?
1932.
We're really going heavy with the forensics.
Yes. Well, it's the Lindbergh baby. Investigators checked for prints in the nursery. Again, no usable fingerprints or footprints were found, leading experts to conclude that the kidnapper or kidnappers wore gloves and had some type of cloth on the soles of their shoes. What's bizarre is that no adult fingerprints were found in the baby's room, including areas witnesses admitted to touching.
That's weird.
The only fingerprints that were found belonged to baby Charlie. Officially, Colonel H. Norman Schwarzkopf of the New Jersey State Police was the lead investigator, but for whatever reason, he willingly ceded major responsibility for the investigation to Charles Lindbergh. And I know what you're thinking. Charles is a pilot, not a police officer. And there's also a bit of a conflict of interest.
A little bit.
No. He's so invested, he won't stop.
If anyone wants to find Charlie, it's his dad.
Yeah.
So put him in charge.
Seems like a good choice.
Yes. So why did the lead investigator give in and give up the investigation to Charles? Well, Charles was inserting himself into the investigation anyway, insisting on approving decisions and handling ransom negotiations and just controlling access to leads. So he was like in the way anyway. So Schwarzkopf was like, I don't want to challenge a national hero. So instead of asserting his full police authority, he deferred all investigation decisions to Charles.
It's kind of like, you think you can do my job better? Go for it.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Fun.
And I know that this is going to shock you guys. Charles's lack of experience had a serious negative impact on the investigation.
What do you mean?
Shocked as hell.
We'll get into it a little later, but basically, instead of having a law enforcement run controlled sting for ransom exchanges and negotiations, he chose to use civilians as intermediaries, as well as like some potential suspects and tips weren't pursued because Lindbergh didn't believe in them. Footprints near the house were trampled on and pieces of evidence were handled by random people at the scene. And overall, the investigators, the local, state, and federal agencies had to work around Lindbergh's interference, which slowed and fragmented the process.
He's keeping them on their toes.
Yes.
It's
on March 2nd, the following, so after baby Lindbergh was kidnapped, the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, contacted the Trenton, New Jersey Police Department. He told them that they could contact the FBI for any resources and would provide any assistance if they needed it. So they were like, we'll help you. On March 6th, a second ransom note was received. It was postmarked from Brooklyn, New York. This is a couple ransom notes. But the second one said, Dear Sir, so the first one, I was kind of trying to read it the way it was written. I don't want to do that because it's hard. Just know that there's a bunch of spelling errors throughout. So it says, "Dear sir, we have warned you, note, to make anything public. Also notify the police. Now you have to take consequences. Means we will have to hold the baby until everything is quiet. We can note, make any appointments just now. We know very well that we know very well what it means to us. It is really necessary to make a world affair out of this, or to get your baby back as soon as possible. To settle those affairs in a quick way will be better for both. Don't be afraid about the baby keeping care of us day and night. We also will feed him according to the diet. We are interested to send him back in gut health, and ransom was made us for $50,000, but now we have to take another person to it and probably have to keep the baby for a longer time as we expected. So the amount will be $70,000, $20,000 in $50 bills, $25,000 in $20 bills, $15,000 in $10 bills, and $10,000 in $5 bills. Don't mark any bills or take them from one serial number. We will form you later were to deliver the Mooney, but we will note do so until the police is out of the case and the papers are quiet. The kidnapping we prepared in years, so we are prepared for everything."
I like that you said you weren't going to read it as written and immediately read it as written.
I meant that I'm not going to pause and be like, they spelled really wrong. They spelled according wrong. Spelled amount wrong. But I want to see if Bailey picked up on something. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read this part again. And I want Bailey specifically to kind of pay attention to it. And keep in mind that they think that the kidnapper who is writing this letter is foreign.
Mm-hmm.
"We are interested to send him back in gut health." How is gut spelled?
G-U-T.
What word do you think they meant?
Good. So are we dealing with a German?
Why do you say that?
Because gut, G-U-T-E, is good in German. I caught it in the first letter, too.
Good. Just something to keep in mind in the back of your head. So this note, as you may have deciphered, increased the demand to $70,000 and reiterated that there should be no police involvement. In total, 13 ransom notes were received by the Lindberghs.
God.
That feels like a lot to me.
Feels like a lot.
After various attempts to contact the kidnappers failed, a retired New York City teacher named John F. Condon placed an ad in a Bronx newspaper on March 8th, 1932, so a week after the kidnapping. In the ad he posted, he offered to act as an intermediary between the Lindberghs and the kidnappers. The following day, Condon received a note. The note was from the kidnappers approving of him acting as a go-between. They wrote him a letter saying, "Dear sir, if you are willing to act as a go-between in the Lindbergh case, please follow strictly instruction. Handle enclosed letter personally to Mr. Lindbergh. It will explain everything. Don't tell anyone about it. As soon as we find out the press or police is notified, everything is canceled, and it will be a further delay. After you get the money from Mr. Lindbergh, put these three words in the New York American," which is a newspaper. "Money is ready. After notice, we will give you further instruction. Don't be afraid. We are not out for your $1,000. Keep it. Only act strictly. Be at home every night between 6 and 12. By this time, you will hear from us." And then the note that he was supposed to give to Mr. Lindbergh. "Dear sir, please handle enclosed letter to Colonel Lindbergh. It is in Mr. Lindbergh's interest not to notify police. So, dear sir, Mr. Condon may act as a go-between. You can give him the $70,000, make one packet the size will be about," and then he like drew a picture of a box. "We have notified you already in what kind of bills. We warn you not to set any trap in any way. If you or someone else will notify the police, there will be a further delay, After we have the money in hand, we will tell you where to find your boy. You may have an airplane ready. It is about 150 miles away. But before telling you the odor, a delay of 8 hours will be between. Over the next couple weeks, Condon would place ads in the newspaper columns under the pseudonym Jaffsy, which is a play on his name, because it's his name is, or his initials. His name is John F. Condon, so JFC, Jaffsy. And the kidnappers would respond via note. So he would place an ad in the newspaper, and then like the following day, he'd get a note from the kidnappers. Mr. Condon, we trust you, but we will note come in your house. It is danger. Even you cannot know if police or Secret Service is watching you. Follow this instruction. Take a car and drive it to the last subway station from Drone Avenue. Here, 100 feet from this last station, on the left side, is an empty Frankfurter stand with a big open porch around. You will find a notice in the center of the porch underneath a stove. This notice will tell you where to find us. Act accordingly. After 3/4 of an hour, be on the place. Bring the money with you. So that was the one about meeting. And he called the empty hot dog stand a Frankfurter stand. Condon found the hidden note, which read, cross the street and follow the fence from the cemetery direction to 233rd Street. I will meet you. On March 12th, Condon arrived at the prearranged spot. A man emerged from the shadows and introduced himself as John. He told Condon that the baby was still alive and unharmed, but would only be returned once the ransom was paid. Condon asked John how they could be sure that the baby was the Lindbergh baby. So John agreed to send proof. On March 16th, Condon received Charlie's pajamas as proof of identity. And within 2 weeks, the kidnappers demanded delivery of the ransom. The ransom drop was planned for April 2nd in St. Raymond's Cemetery in the Bronx. Condon arrived with Charles waiting in a nearby car. Condon had only brought $50,000, primarily in gold certificates, with him. The certificates had serial numbers, which had been recorded by the Treasury Department. So they didn't mark the bills. They just like wrote down which bills were going to be exchanged in the ransom. When John emerged from the shadows, Condon negotiated with him, getting him to agree to the original ransom rather than the $70,000. John took the money, and in exchange, he gave another note to Condon. This note said, "The boy is on the boat Nelly. It is a small boat, 28 feet long. Two persons are on the boat. They are innocent. You will find the boat between Horseneck Beach and Gay Head over Elizabeth Island." So Lindbergh himself led the ultimately unsuccessful search for the Nelly, and the team of investigators were forced to concede that they had gained nothing in return for the ransom money. So they just could not find that boat. They went to where they said that it would be. There's no boat named the Nelly. So this is what I referred to earlier, how Charles used intermediaries instead of a controlled sting operation. Like,
yeah.
So the search continued. Police released the serial numbers on the bills given to John to the public. They notified the banks, and they published the serial numbers in newspapers. And we're just like, everybody keep an eye out. So while Charles was compromising the investigation, Anne was advised to remain calm and private for her own health's sake. She avoided the public as much as possible. And I'll get into it later, but she had some health-related things going on at this time. On May 12th, 1932, William Allen, a truck driver, was delivering a load of sand when he pulled over to relieve himself on the side of the road. He was stopped about 5 miles southeast of the Lindbergh home, near Mount Rose, New Jersey. As he entered into a little grove of trees to urinate, he noticed something in a shallow depression about 45 feet from the road.
Oh no.
He got closer to get a better look. There he found, partly buried under leaves and brush, the badly decomposed remains of a small child. The skull was badly fractured and the body had been scavenged by animals.
A couple miles from their house?
5 miles southeast.
They probably killed him right away, didn't they?
After the news, all of these cars showed up to where they found the baby's body. This is just people. Random people coming to see. After 72 days, Charles Jr., the Lindbergh baby, had been found. The body had been identified as Charlie by his clothing. He was wearing a shirt Betty Gao had made for him. And he was also identified by his distinct physical features. He had a dimple on his chin, and the toes on his right foot overlapped. I had a little fun with the animation. Did you see it? Oh. Ready?
Yeah.
It's like from the movies when it spins in.
It just went from being blank to both of the newspaper pictures.
You didn't see the animation?
I'm sorry.
Oh.
In there, I thought it was because I blinked, but
yeah. You missed it. Here, I'll take a quick video.
How important is this?
It's not, but I put effort into it.
Oh.
Okay. An autopsy found that the Lindbergh baby had been killed by a blow to the head during or shortly after the kidnapping. The autopsy also revealed that many of the toddler's organs were missing, but investigators chalked that up to foraging animals. He was in the woods, after all.
Yeah.
Charles insisted on cremation, which... he had a fractured skull and his organs were foraged.
Yeah.
Until now, the FBI had been acting purely in an advisory capacity. But the day after they found Charlie, May 13th, President Herbert Hoover authorized the Bureau to serve as the primary federal agency on the case. And the full resources of the DOJ were committed to the investigation. So, Charles was no longer in charge. So maybe we can make some headway with this. On June 22nd, 1932, Charlie's second birthday, or what would have been his second birthday, Congress passed the Federal Kidnapping Act, also known as the Lindbergh Law. This made kidnapping across state lines a federal crime and stipulated that such an offense could be punished by death. In June 1932, officials began to suspect that the crime had been perpetrated by someone the Lindberghs knew. They focused their attention on John Condon and the Lindbergh House staff. Suspicion fell on Violet Sharp, a British household servant at the Morrow home, who had given contradictory information regarding her whereabouts on the night of the kidnapping. It was reported that she appeared nervous and suspicious when questioned. She died of suicide on June 10th, 1932. Hmm. So just as investigators were starting to look towards the household staff, She ingested a silver polish that contained cyanide just before being questioned for the fourth time.
She's a spy.
Interesting.
Her alibi was later confirmed, and police were later criticized for being heavy-handed.
Heavy-handed? They're investigating a baby who's beaten to death.
Yeah, but... it was the 30s, so I don't know if the questioning was just asking questions.
Mm.
I mean, they confirmed that her alibi was valid, so she did not kidnap the baby, but she felt so worried, she killed herself.
Or well, she we're trying knew to something.
Find a murderer.
Okay.
A child That's murderer. Fair.
That's a good point, Lacey. Condon was also questioned by police, and his home was searched, but nothing incriminating was found. Charles Lindbergh stood by Condon during this time, and Condon actually continued being helpful, aiding the Bureau in constructing a profile of John. It was around this time when the gold certificates began to surface in the New York area.
Oh.
But, so this was like June 1932. Nothing really came of that. They just started kind of popping up sporadically. In April 1933, President Franklin D. Roosevelt issued an executive order requiring all gold certificates in circulation must be exchanged for Federal Reserve notes by May. This was done to prevent hoarding of gold during the Great Depression. But as like a side effect of this, it aided the investigation pretty significantly. Shortly before 10 a.m. on September 15th, 1934, Walter Lyle, a gas station manager in Upper Manhattan, accepted a bill from a customer he felt was behaving suspiciously. Fearing that the man may be a counterfeiter, he wrote down the customer's license plate in the bill's margin. 3 days later, on September 18th, the gas station made its deposit at the bank, and a bank teller received the bill with the license plate number written on it. The bill, being unusual, i.e. they had removed the gold certificates from circulation, and it had writing on it, it kind of, like, caught her attention. So she checked the serial number and discovered that it had been flagged as being part of the ransom payment. The bank immediately notified federal investigations, who traced the license plate number written on the bill to a dark blue Dodge sedan registered to a Bronx residence, to the Bronx residence of a German carpenter. Bruno Hauptmann was arrested on September 19th, 1934. He had a $20 gold certificate from the ransom payment in his wallet at the time of his arrest.
He was holding it for a friend.
That's literally what he says. Bruno Richard Hauptmann was born in November 1899 in Saxony, Germany. He served in the German army during World War I, but after the war, he started a life of crime. He was involved in several burglaries and robberies. He was arrested and spent some time in prison before he escaped and stowed away on a ship to the U.S. in 1923. He seemingly reinvented himself upon arriving in the U.S. He settled in the Bronx, married a German woman named Anna, and had a son, and he began working as a carpenter. And he started doing pretty well financially until the Great Depression hit. After Bruno was arrested, evidence against him started mounting. His home was searched, and the police found about $13,750 in the gold certificates from the ransom hidden in a can in his garage. For reference, that's about $300,000 today.
That's not his can.
Condon was able to identify Bruno as John from the graveyard. As you can see, that's the sketch that Condon helped create, and that's Bruno next to it. Handwriting experts compared Bruno's known handwriting to the ransom notes and found that the penmanship was stylistically consistent. It also didn't help his case that he had experienced burglaring. When presented with the evidence, Bruno claimed he was holding the money for a friend and business partner, Isidore Fisch. Isidore had returned to Germany in 1933 and had died in March 1934. On September 24, 1934, Bruno was indicted in the Bronx for extorting the ransom money from Charles Lindbergh. And on October 8th, he was indicted for the murder of baby Charlie. On January 2nd, 1935, jury selection began in the case of the State of New Jersey versus Bruno. I'm tired of saying his full name. The capital murder trial began the following day. The evidence presented by the state included the ladder, the ransom notes, and the ransom money. Tool marks on the ladder found at the scene seemingly matched tool marks owned by Bruno. Wood experts testified that one of the ladder rungs was made from a floorboard from Bruno's attic. The handwriting experts testified that the spelling quirks, phrasing, and handwriting style matched between Bruno's samples and the ransom notes. Also, obviously, all the ransom money found in Bruno's possession was a big thing for evidence.
It was his friends.
Other more circumstantial evidence included phone numbers and addresses connected to the ransom negotiations were found in Bruno's possession. Condon's telephone number was found written on a closet door frame in Bruno's home.
You know, when you can't find a pad and pen.
But also, like, why would he need Condon's phone number?
Well, you know.
The state told the court that Bruno himself was suspicious in that his alibis were conflicting, they'd caught him in lies about small details, and his finances didn't add up. Despite business being slow, Bruno had purchased a $400 radio, which is like $9,500 today, and he sent his wife on a trip to Germany. Charles took the stand himself and testified that he recognized Bruno's voice from the night of the ransom payment. Other witnesses testified that it was Bruno who had spent some of the Lindbergh gold certificates, and he had been seen in the area of the estate near Hopewell on the day of the kidnapping, and that he had been absent from work on the day of the ransom payment and had quit his job 2 days later. The defense pointed out that Bruno's fingerprints were never found on the money or the ransom notes. They told the court that Isidore Fisch had given Bruno a shoebox to store before he went back to Germany. Bruno didn't open it. He just put it on the top shelf of his kitchen broom closet. After he found out that Fish died, he opened the box and found it full of money. So he spent some of it because Fish actually owed him money. Additionally, at the time of the kidnapping, Bruno was at home with his wife, and Anna testified to that. Although, on cross-examination, she admitted that while she hung her apron every day on a hook higher than the top shelf in the broom closet, she could not remember seeing any shoebox there. Bruno's lawyers also argued that the wood evidence was fabricated or misinterpreted, pointing out that the chain of custody was shaky. They also noted that many carpenters use similar wood and tools. His team also brought in their own handwriting experts who said the similarities were not conclusive. They accused the state of forcing comparisons to look more alike. And they argued that all the evidence was circumstantial. The state was simply desperate for a conviction, and Bruno was a convenient scapegoat. Okay. Bruno never stopped professing his innocence when he took the stand. He claimed the police beat him several times and forced him to produce handwriting samples that matched the ransom notes. During cross, rebuttal witnesses testified that Fish could not have been at the scene of the crime, and that he had no money for medical treatments when he died of tuberculosis. Fish's landlady testified that he could barely afford the $3.50 weekly rent of his room, so there was no way that he gave away a box full of money. The trial lasted 5 weeks, and the jury deliberated for 11 hours before returning a verdict of guilty on February 13th, 1935. Bruno Hauptmann was sentenced to death. Following the trial, the Lindberghs traveled to Europe for privacy. The trial had been intensely publicized, and the couple was under constant scrutiny. They returned in December of 1935. A series of appeals ultimately reaching the Supreme Court in December 1935 was unsuccessful. At the end of March 1936, Bruno was offered to commute his sentence from the death penalty to life without parole in exchange for his confession. He refused. Bruno was executed by electric chair on April 3rd, 1936. Following his execution, the Lindberghs retreated further from the public. About About 5 months after Charlie's kidnapping and murder, the Lindberghs actually welcomed their second child, a son named John.
So this she was that. She was pregnant when he was kidnapped? Holy shit.
This was that health-related thing that I mentioned earlier. That's why her doctor was like, you need to stay calm. God. Because she was pregnant at the time that Charlie was kidnapped. So, like,
yeah,
that's pretty stressful. And then on top of that, during her pregnancy, the Lindberghs received a large number of letters and phone calls threatening her unborn baby.
Oh my God.
Wow.
So, see, Anne stayed out of the public eye as much as possible. And as soon as Bruno was executed, the Lindberghs started staying for extended periods of time in Europe. It was during these trips that Charles Lindbergh actually met Hitler and other German leaders. We're taking a weird turn. Strap in, Lacey. He admired their air power. But with the outbreak of World War II, the Lindberghs returned to the U.S. Back in the States, Lindbergh attended an American First Committee and actually became their leader, giving a speech opposing the U.S. entry into the war. During his speeches, he included remarks about the, quote, threat of Jewish influence, pushing the U.S. toward the war. Lindbergh later claimed he was not promoting Nazi ideology, just defending U.S. neutrality. To be clear, modern scholars have analyzed his letters, diaries, private conversations, and speeches, and have determined that he held a eugenic view that was consistent with many American intellectuals, scientists, and politicians in the early 1900s. So they were saying, like, although it's wrong now, back then, that was what a lot of people thought. At the time, eugenics was considered a legitimate scientific and social movement in the U.S. These people encouraged those with desirable traits to have children and wanted to use birth control or sterilization processes to limit undesirable traits and hereditary diseases. All this is relevant, I promise. So, since the trial, many modern historians and legal analysts have found issues in the evidence presented. The ransom money being found in Bruno's possession is still strong evidence against him, but no fingerprints were found on it. It's also strange that, like, he had so much left. Why wasn't he spending it? If, like, their whole thing was he kidnapped the baby for the money, why did he still have so much of it?
Well, I mean, they put it in the newspapers or wherever, like, hey, these are the cereals.
Yeah, so maybe he was just not spending it.
Yeah, like, he did wait like a couple years before using it.
But what people now are looking back on, they're wondering, could the money have been planted or mishandled? The fish defense seems unlikely, but it's not impossible. Critics of the latter evidence argue it was circumstantial at best, especially with the chain of custody not being perfectly documented. Even though modern experts say the match was probably correct, methods in the 1930s were lacking in rigor. Also, handwriting analysis is considered less reliable these days than it was before, and critics believe confirmation bias may have played a role in matching the handwriting samples. Many legal scholars argue that the case had the hallmarks of a rush to judgment. With media pressure, political pressure, and the Lindbergh's celebrity status, an acquittal was nearly impossible. Critics say the state relied too heavily on circumstantial evidence without physical proof. However, the general consensus among historians and legal analysts is that Bruno was likely guilty. At the very least, he was involved. Others have more disturbing theories, in my opinion. Lise Perlman, a retired California judge, speculates that Charles Lindbergh sacrificed his son for scientific experiments that led to the child's death. Perlman acknowledged that her findings were based on circumstantial yet compelling evidence about the crime scene, the condition of the boy's remains, and the research that Lindbergh was conducting at the time with Dr. Alexis Carroll. Dr. Carroll was a Nobel Prize-winning surgeon and organ transplant pioneer, and a known eugenist who had a history of conducting controversial medical experiments. He was also someone Charles admired. Perlman said she considered the apparent absence of blood in the woods where the body was discovered as a smoking gun that proved the boy died somewhere else. Fair. Unexplored questions about the condition of the body and items found nearby have led her to speculate that Lindbergh colluded with Dr. Carroll to experiment on his son. She wrote in a book that she wrote that the boy, who had an unusually large head and took medicines associated with rickets, would have been seen as expendable to the men, who believed in improving the genetic quality of the population. She concluded that there was a horrendous probability that the men removed his organs in hope of achieving a medical breakthrough that might help Lindbergh's sister-in-law, who had a damaged heart valve.
Seems like a wild reach to me.
Yeah. To reach this conclusion, Perlman worked with a New Jersey pathologist, Dr. Speth, who evaluated records from the crime scene and autopsy, which showed that all the boy's organs, other than the heart and liver, were missing. At the time, investigators deduced that foraging animals had mutilated the body as it lay in the woods. Dr. Speth said that the apparent absence of vermin on the boy's remains and clues suggesting that the child's face and one of his feet decayed more slowly than other parts of the body indicated that the body had been dumped in the woods well after the abduction and that chemicals commonly found in laboratories had also probably been used. Others believe that that theory is completely absurd. So I'm just going to briefly tell you some other theories. Charlie may have been dropped from the ladder during the kidnapping and died by accident. This would explain why his body was found so close to home. Another theory is that the household staff may have had more to do with the kidnapping than thought. Someone may have provided information about the baby's routine and unlocked the window.
Plus, they had to know which room the baby was in.
Yeah.
Unless they actually climbed up and peeked in a couple before they found the right room, but like...
That's risky.
Yeah.
Another theory is that maybe a gang or the mob was involved. Apparently, mob figures had offered to help locate the baby in exchange for a reduced prison sentence. This theory is supported by the ransom note's tone and style that suggested more than one person was involved. Maybe the body wasn't Charlie after all. Maybe it was another child planted to end the search. This is more of a conspiracy theory, but I thought I'd mention it anyway. The final theory is maybe Charles Lindbergh dropped Charlie in an attempt to test his son's toughness and then staged the kidnapping. So John, Lindbergh's second son, grew up to become a very successful underwater diver, being one of the world's earliest aquanauts.
Oh, cool.
But as a child, his dad taught him how to swim when he was 3 years old by repeatedly throwing him into the deep end of a swimming pool.
A sink or swim.
In an attempt for John to learn to protect himself, in the spring of 1940, Charles placed his 7-year-old son in a pasture with a budding ram.
Okay. You can dodge a ram, you can dodge a ball.
Okay. As a teenager, John was allowed to make a solo 3-day boat trip, and he also learned to fly before he left for college. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that Charles Lindbergh may have unintentionally harmed his first son.
I think it's, like you said, not out of the realm of possibility that he might have, like, tried to toughen him up or whatever. But I think just dropping a baby to see how tough they are is a weird... Like, I would think if we're going down that road, it would be more likely that the baby was dropped by accident by somebody who then decided to cover it up versus he dropped the kid on his head because that's where the injuries were to see
well, how tough he was. Lacey, I don't know if you're aware of this, but when you drop a baby, the head goes down regardless of how you drop the baby.
Yeah, but like, but why would you drop a baby in any direction just to see, like, what's he going to prove? You better land on your feet, boy.
I don't know. It doesn't seem, I mean, I was going to say, like, he put his son with a ram, like a hostile animal.
Yeah, but like a 7-year-old son, you know?
That's true.
I don't know. Feels like a weird thing, but I could see maybe doing something and dropping him by accident, him or a staff member or somebody, and then trying to cover it up. But then you have to cover it up. Part of the cover up would be going out and like making a ladder and like propping the ladder up against the house and making a letter with weird handwriting. And
I could see it being like multiple kidnappers. And one of them was an inside man who unlocked the window and told them where to go.
Yeah, I based on what you've told us so far, I kind of lean towards somebody
and then
being involved.
Personally, I've never climbed down a ladder while holding a baby, but I feel as though it would be difficult. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's too hard to believe that maybe the baby was dropped. I do think it's weird that there wasn't blood at the scene. Mm-hmm. But then again,
how long was he missing before we found the remains though?
72 days.
But you would think that they'd find the blood right away because they found like the footstep impression.
Yeah, what I mean is like if he was dropped while they were coming down the ladder, you would expect to see some kind of blood right under the window. Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Because if the kidnapper was at the top of the ladder and dropped Charlie, so Charlie would hit the ground and then bleed out while the kidnapper was coming down. Yeah. I know it would only take like a minute, but like it's still a little bit of blood.
Yeah. And they went out and checked under the window, like as soon as they realized the baby was missing. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if the kidnapper climbed up the window and the inside person handed the baby out the window to them.
Yeah. And then
otherwise you have to not just climb down the ladder, but get out the window while holding a baby.
And then the other thing is that, to remind you, the only fingerprints found in the baby's room were his. The baby.
And that's weird. So because you like would think that they were in there, everybody in there checking everything out, somebody who was there came behind him and just like quick wiped stuff down that like the adults were touching.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so I see it because
I kind of think that somebody handed the baby out the window, like Lacey said, and then wiped the whole room down. And then the baby was maybe dropped or something. I don't know. To wrap this up, Charles and Anne Lindbergh went on to have a total of 6 children, including baby Charlie. So after John, they had a baby they named Land. L-A-N-D.
Okay.
Okay.
Isn't there Land in their family somewhere?
Yes. So Charles's mom was named Evangeline Land something. Okay. Land Lodge. So her middle name was Land. Still a weird name for a baby.
Yeah.
Land was born in 1937. Anne Spencer was born in 1940. Scott was born in 1942. And Reeve was born in 1945. They never discussed the kidnapping with their other children and became very protective over them. Sure. They lived in relative seclusion, traveling overseas often, and emphasized education, privacy, and exploration. Charles Lindbergh died on August 26, 1974, at the age of 72, in Maui, due to an illness related to cancer. After his death, in the early 2000s, a pretty big secret was revealed. So remember how his grandfather left his wife and 7 children to move to the United States with his mistress and son, and then had 6 more kids.
Yeah.
Charles, turns out, had 3 mistresses.
Oh.
Apparently, in 1957, Charles started an affair with a 31-year-old German woman named Brigitte Hesheimer. Their affair lasted until his death. Together, they had 3 children, Dirk, Astrid, and David. Charles visited 2 to 3 times a year, and he and Brigitte kept his identity a secret from their children. He would go by the pseudonym Dr. Carew Kent. Mr. Carew Kent, not a doctor. His second mistress was Marietta Hesheimer.
Sister?
Bridget's sister.
Oh my God.
They had 2 children together, Vago and Christoph. They kept his identity a secret as well.
Did the sisters know about each other?
I don't know.
They definitely knew that they were the side piece because they knew that he was Charles Lindbergh, so they would have known he was married.
Yeah.
So they were happy to be the mistress, whether or not they knew there was another mistress.
His third mistress was named Valeska. She worked as Charles's German translator and private secretary. They too had 2 children together. So Charles, just for a recap, had 6 kids with his wife, 3 with his first mistress, 2 with his second, and 2 with his third.
It's like Nick Cannon.
13 killed kids in total.
Almost caught up with his grandfather.
Maybe that was the goal.
Yeah.
Anne died on February 7th, 2001, at the age of 94 in Wyoming, of natural causes. I think she died before all this came out. So.
Good. Thank God.
So, what do you think? Was Bruno guilty? Was he railroaded? Or perhaps maybe he didn't work alone? What do you think?
I don't know. I don't know if I think he's guilty or not, but I do think somebody in the house was involved. And I like to think it wasn't the baby's father. That was a household staff. But I think somebody inside had to have been involved.
I agree.
And, oh, I forgot. I just remembered that one person that they were interviewing who killed herself.
Yeah.
Well,
that's pretty suspicious.
I think it's suspicious.
If Bruno have the chance to, like, explain what happened and then not be put to death.
Which, yeah.
Like, even if you, like, I mean, even if you didn't do it, like, wouldn't you just kind of say, okay, this is what happened? Like,
well, I think that depends, because if he admitted to it, he would have had life in prison, right? And at this point, he'd already been in jail for a little bit. Maybe he was being poorly treated by the other inmates and was like, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life.
So the electric chair over beatings?
I did forget that the electric chair was the way. That is kind of horrifying.
I don't know. I just feel like if you were, like, an innocent guy, wouldn't you rather take that risk of being in prison for life with the possibility of, like, justice comes out
years later? I think that that's, like, on the other hand, though, Bailey, if he was guilty and he knew he was guilty, why wouldn't he just confess? If he, like, you know? With the whole thing, like, he was beatings and stuff.
But, like, some of them don't confess, though. Like, how many serial killers just don't talk?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, no.
There she goes.
It's okay.
Oh, okay, she's still there.
I thought we lost you for real.
Maybe he did do it, but, like, didn't want to give away the inside person who helped him and didn't know how to, like, confess to it without explaining their involvement. So maybe it was, like, a protecting somebody else kind of thing.
Yeah.
Didn't you?
I would.
That he had the one guy's information in like the closet.
Or his phone number or something, right?
Yeah, he said that he must have seen it in like a newspaper and just like jotted it down
on the wall.
But that doesn't really explain it. Like, why is it on your closet wall?
But also, like, didn't that guy who like, what was his name?
Condon?
Yeah. Didn't he insert himself in the...
Yeah, but to be fair, in his defense, a lot of people were offering to be the go-between.
That just seems crazy.
It does. It does seem... Like, when he, like, inserted himself, I was like, that's suspicious.
Yeah.
Because don't killers like to insert themselves into the investigation?
Yeah.
But, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how I feel about Charles Lindbergh. I know that he's saying he wasn't a Nazi, but he had viewpoints that at the time were pretty common. But then, you know, he also didn't seem like a great dad.
Or husband.
Or husband. Yeah, that's true. He had several affairs.
You could also point out that it's a little sketchy that he just wanted to cremate the body.
And he also took over the investigation.
Yeah. Oh.
It just seems strange to me.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's, yeah.
I wonder if, okay, this is a crazy theory. And it's the one I think we should end on. What if he was having an affair with the person in the household who killed herself?
Mm.
And she killed herself because she was worried about the affair coming out. Like, what if it wasn't, what if she was guilty of something, but it wasn't to do with the kidnapping?
Yeah. And
it's okay.
She thought that it would come to light during the investigation.
Yeah. I mean, that's not going to look good.
It sounds like it would be on par for him.
Yeah, it's very on brand for him.
On brand.
And then I do think it's very, like, I'm suspicious of a lot of people here. I want to believe that Bruno had something to do with it because he was put to death for it.
Yeah.
And also he had all those gold certificates in his possession. But then people are like, well, they could have been planted. They didn't have fingerprints on them.
Yeah, but could they have been planted? Like, he had one in his wallet.
Yeah. You could say that it was planted about literally any evidence that's found.
You know, police have found drugs in cars before that they've just pulled out of their pocket and put in the drug in the car.
Yeah.
So, and I feel like back then, with such a high profile case, they were really eager to close it.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm very caught up in all the forensics that they tried to use. Like, we also glossed over the fact that there was a wood expert.
Yeah.
What was that?
I don't know. I thought that was great. I pictured Ron Swanson.
No, it's actually, it's Ron not Swanson. Maple. It's oak. From.
I thought it was Ron Swanson.
I mean, it could have been. But like, what?
I don't know. Well, that was sinister.
And we were sarcastic. And confused.
Hope you keep listening.